Transitions podcast was created to promote individual healing and growth, and to prevent or minimize the depression, anxiety, and frustration that often comes with an LDS faith crisis or awakening. It's my ethical obligation as a licensed psychologist to note that what you're about to hear may sound like psychotherapy, but it's not. It is a practical tool to help you make your journey toward authenticity without sacrificing the best parts of your life. Mormon Transitions is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormontransitions.org and clicking on the yellow button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Transitions are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Transitions. I'm your host, Dr. Christy Money, and tonight I am thrilled to let you guys know that Mitzi has agreed to come back to tell us more about her sexual journey and the difficulties she's been able to work through. Now, this is part two to part one that we released last week with both she and her husband. So, Mitzi, thank you so much for being willing to come back on and tell me more of your story.
Yeah, you're welcome. This is something that I've been struggling with and working so hard for 10 years. And it's like, if I can help someone else to speed up that process, that would be a good thing. So,
yeah, I hear you. It's really something that I think so many Mormon women struggle with, and it's kind of taboo to talk about, right? Women's sexuality is seems like it's off limits way too often, and it's not handled well when, especially if men are talking about it, it's like, oh, great. So, you know, it's just the two of us and all these listeners. That's why you're really courageous.
I'm just going to pretend it's just the two of us.
Well, you brave soul. All right. Where would you like to begin?
I'll just start with just kind of a little bit of my history. Like, I've always been really super boy crazy and had tons of crushes in my life. And I remember my first crush in first grade and had crushes all the way through school and in college. And I was just out of control with my crushes. My roommate was like, "You like everybody." And it was true. I had a crush on a boy on the first floor of the library and a boy on the third floor of the library and a crush on at least one FHE brother every semester and a crush on like a boy in every class. So I was really big into crushes, but it was all more romantic fantasy, and I never really had any sexual fantasies. I have one sexual fantasy that I can remember, and it was when I was in junior high, and my sexual fantasy, the one that I have, is that I would be standing on the sidelines during a football game, and that one of the football players would come over and tackle me and kiss me. And that is my sexual fantasy. So it's so funny, but that's the extent of how far I would kind of go. And I didn't have my first kiss until I was 18, and I didn't kiss anybody again for 4 more years, and I never really got turned on while I was making out. And the exception was with Scott, because I was in love with him, and I knew he really liked it, and I really liked him, and so that turned me on. Mm-hmm. But it didn't last after we got married. So, yeah. But, like, I didn't know what a clitoris was until I was a senior in college, and I was a health education major. It's like, I should have known that, I would think, earlier. And I had to teach sex ed to a class of high schoolers while I was still a virgin. And I remember someone asked the question to me, how do girls masturbate? And I was just horrified. You know, I thought masturbating was this huge sin. And I just said that you absolutely do not need to masturbate to be healthy. And plus, I didn't even know how. So I wouldn't have been able to answer it anyway without researching.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize at the time that, you know, any good Mormon girl or boy would do that. And I was just clueless about it. And I just, I was always afraid of masturbating. I just remember my mom telling me, you know, about it and saying that a married couple she knew got divorced because the husband masturbated and so he didn't need his wife. Oh. And so, anyway, so that was a little bit of that kind of background for me, well, for me as well.
And so it's understandable that sexually there was a bit of underdevelopment. Then I mean, just earlier you were saying, "Oh, I should have known better," but
right.
I don't think so. I mean, you were pretty sheltered by
by
culture and your parents and you're just trying to be a good Mormon girl.
Yeah, and I was really good at being a good Mormon girl. It was super easy for me to do, and so, yeah. Anyway, but like on my honeymoon with Scott, I was so passive, and I didn't have any desires, and I didn't want him to do anything to me, and that was really hard and frustrating for Scott. And at a certain point, he kind of refused to have sex with me, and I didn't know why, and I was like, what is wrong with you? And he felt bad that I hadn't had an orgasm, and he didn't want to have sex with me anymore because he was just feeling guilty about it. And I just remember being like, get over here and have sex with me right now. And, you know, and as a, when I got married, I've always been a little bit of a feminist, and I knew I wanted to have a good sex life for myself, but I just thought it would happen. And so as soon as I got married, I didn't do it before marriage because I thought it would be wrong, but as soon as I got married, I started reading sex books, and I read immediately Between Husband and Wife, that book. And I actually found that book to be a little bit damaging to me because, I don't know, have you read that book?
I have, and I've had clients who have read it too in the early in their journey, and yeah, it wasn't very helpful.
Yeah, the thing that was that I felt like was damaging was that they talked about that. They made it seem to me that the most legitimate marital act was mutual orgasms.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, I can't even have an orgasm. And you're telling me that the legitimate orgasm is when you're both going at the same time. And that just, it just felt like it was setting up an impossible standard for me.
Exactly.
And so
for every woman.
I didn't appreciate that. And so the next book that I read was the book And They Were Not Ashamed. And I felt like that was a good, helpful book. I think that's a good book for any Mormon to read. It's really tame, and I think she has some helpful information in there. But I didn't feel ashamed. I knew sex was good, but I still couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. And Scott and I would go, a bunch of our friends all got married within a few months of each other, and we would go and have, you know, dates with each other. And then after, we would kind of start opening up to them and asking them about stuff, and we would say, you know, they knew that I was hadn't had an orgasm, and they were giving us tips and tricks, and so we would try all these different things, and nothing ever worked. And every time we would try something new and it wouldn't work, I would just get more and more frustrated, and every time I failed, I just kept feeling more and more defective. Yeah. And eventually, it's like not only did his physical touch not turn me on, but it was actually, it sometimes would like make my skin crawl. Mm-hmm. Like it just became almost at certain times like an avulsion.
Yeah.
And like we both kind of would be resentful of each other sometimes. I would be resentful of him because he wanted to have sex all the time, and he would be resentful of me because I wouldn't engage or be vulnerable with him sexually. And, while we were dating, I always felt like Scott kind of had the upper hand. He just was in control of the situation. Like he waited forever to kiss me when I was pretty much ready to kiss him on the first night. And he, we finally talked about getting married. And then he was like, but I don't want to talk about it again, because he felt like if we kept talking about it, it would rush the process, and he didn't want to rush the process. And so I didn't talk about it again. And I just, so the whole time that we're dating, I felt like I was the first one that liked him, and I waited for him to like me back, and I wanted to kiss him, and I waited for him to kiss me. And so he just controlled the dating game the whole time. So when we finally got married and I realized how much he liked having sex with me, I really enjoyed having that power in our relationship, because I felt like he had so much power for so long. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point kind of admitting to Scott and to myself that a part of me almost didn't want to develop some of my sexual desire because I might lose some of that position in the relationship.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And isn't that interesting that, like, in our culture, like, women's sexuality is something that...
It's power, yeah.
Yeah, and it can be really frustrating when, you know, all your life you're told, you know, don't get aroused, you know, that's, mm-hmm. you know, turn it off, like, you know, the musical goes, like a light switch, right? So,
yeah.
To try to suppress it, to be a good Mormon girl, and it sounds to me like you said that you were very good at that,
yes.
you know, that not
like,
having...
I was mm-hmm. too good at it, you
right.
know?
Well,
like, I never, ever had a sexual thought like that. You
yeah.
are not prepared to do well in the bedroom when you get married if you've never had a sexual thought. You just aren't.
Yeah, but not your fault, right? I mean...
No. Yeah, no. I mean, I was doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
Well, that's what we're taught. And
yeah.
So to just, like, turn it on, I mean, it can be so, so difficult because that's
yeah.
something that we feel like we can have control over, or at least, I mean, speaking from my experiences, you know, as a young woman, that's how I felt, like, oh, I'm being good because I'm able to shut it off. You know, and I got
yeah.
really good at learning how to do that. But then, when you're married, orgasms are important, and
yeah.
and we're, and I hear that in your voice, that frustration too, that can build and build.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned when, you know, early on when, you know, the orgasms weren't happening, that it was just, you know, it seemed like too much. You know, it's already hard enough mm-hmm. not to be orgasmic. Compound that with shame that, oh, well, I should be, you know,
yes.
I should be able to do this. It's, yeah. It's,
yeah, I felt very defective. It was yeah. really, I just didn't feel like a real woman. Like, it just felt horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
understandably.
So after about, I don't remember the timeline exactly, maybe 3 to 5 years after marriage, with Scott, you know, he was gently prodding me the whole time. He was very patient and kind, but also trying to push me to work on this. And he convinced me, and he bought me a vibrator, and that helped a lot. And I had a really hard time kind of getting over that too, and actually trying to use it. And it helped a lot, but I still, it didn't help me enough to get all the way, you know, to have an orgasm, but it did help. And finally, by this point, it was just all the frustrations that we'd had in the bedroom. I just stopped having the attitude of, you know, being so orgasm focused and just tried to enjoy other aspects of it. And then we both definitely started enjoying sex more at that point, when I just kind of let go of let go of the pressure and the hope of orgasm, and just tried to be more present in what was happening.
That doesn't sound sad at all. It sounds like exactly what helped. I mean,
yeah,
that the pressure that we put on ourselves to perform, to reach orgasms, men and women both, they call it, you know, performance anxiety, you know, that
right.
that can really interfere. And I mean, we come by it honestly, because it's natural to want an orgasm. I mean, who doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
But I can see how you, and I'm really impressed by how you're able to recognize that, you know, okay, this is counterproductive. I'm just going to enjoy the sensations as they come, whether or not, you know,
we'll go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it's paradoxical almost, right? That's
mm-hmm.
taking the pressure off. That's
right.
What helps. So.
Yeah. And it's still, don't worry, we're still very much early in my journey
mm-hmm.
before I've had more success, but about 7 years, after marriage, I finally got the courage to talk to my OBGYN nurse about testosterone cream, because I had heard from someone that they had gotten cream and from their doctor, and it helped them in the bedroom. And so I finally opened up to my nurse, and I'm crying because I'm so embarrassed, and I'm 30 years old, and I'm anorgasmic, and she was very dismissive. Yeah, it was awful. She was, yeah, so it made me cry because I was just so vulnerable, and I didn't want to ask her in the first place, but I'm like, you know, I really need to explore every option, you know? And so I finally got brave enough to ask her, and she just kind of made a joke about it, and she was like, oh, well, you know, if it was only so easy to just have cream to have an orgasm, everyone would get it. And
and then
she proceeded to tell me that, you know, sex is just in your head, and tried to give me tips. And I'm like, listen, lady, like, you have no idea how much stuff on sex I read. Like,
you're the expert.
I know it's in your head, but it's not working. Anyway, yeah. So that just made me feel, you know, more defective, and it was humiliating to me, and I never wanted to ask anyone about it again. Like, I just shut that idea off.
After an experience like that, who would blame you? That horrible bedside manners.
No, it was so bad. Oh man. Yeah. And, you know, for me now, I mean, here I am on here talking about sex and my lack of, you know, my problems, but even back just 3 or 4 years ago, I couldn't even talk about it. And so, you know, to finally open up and have her make a joke about it was just awful. So
yeah, not what you needed. You needed her to listen and to be responsive to your needs.
Yeah. And maybe she hadn't heard, and she actually hadn't heard of that. And maybe she just felt dumb that she didn't know. I don't know, but it's just like, but about 2 years ago, I read Dr. Fife's dissertation, and she's a Mormon sex therapist, if anyone doesn't know. And I read it, and I just kind of saw how the role of patriarchy is damaging to female sexuality. And I definitely fit the model of, you know, wanting to be desired but not desiring myself. And I started to listen to any of the podcasts by Dr. Fife or Natasha Parker, and I would listen to them over and over. And I found the Rational Faith Ask of Mormon Sex Therapist series to be tremendously helpful. And I read Passionate Marriage and Mating in Captivity. And I also took Dr. Fife's Art of Desire class online. So, you know, I'm working, I'm learning, I'm trying things, and it's still, you know, at one point I wondered if I was actually asexual. I'm like, maybe this is just not possible for me. Like, maybe I'm not even a heterosexual. Maybe I'm asexual. But then I was like thinking about of all the strong emotions that I've had. I'm like, no, I'm not asexual. But part of the reason that Scott divulged his relationship with porn to me was because he knew that the key element that I was missing was arousal. And he also knew that porn was really good for arousal. But then we had the huge roller coaster of that disclosure, you know, and I'm freaking out and trying to decide if I should force him into a rehab and just all this stuff. But at the same time, on good days, I was more open, and I was like, okay, I've tried everything else, and this is, what, 8 years of marriage, and I've tried everything, and I need to try this too. And so Scott kind of created a special blog for me with just really vanilla, like, female friendly PG-13-ish porn. And I looked at it, and it did kind of help arouse me, but I wasn't very comfortable with that. And we tried erotic stories, and I liked that better. I think women in general, you know, we're not as visual as men are, and I think in our mind is better. But for me, I think part of the reason that I've struggled so much in the bedroom is because I have zero imagination. And so I never came up with anything on my own. So I really did need something else.
Well,
go ahead.
I do think you might be being a bit hard on yourself. growing up as a good Mormon girl, you're not supposed to have creativity or imagination about erotica. Like, that is not... Yeah.
No.
Something we're taught to do in relief society. So
no. I just mean kind of in general, like in creative writing class when they would ask us to write a fiction story, like that was just like my nightmare, you know. So I just don't naturally have a big imagination, I guess is what I'm saying. And so yeah, take that with good Mormon girl syndrome and, you know, it's just a bad combination.
Yeah.
So I needed more help, and so Scott would kind of he searched it all out for me, so I didn't have to try to find stuff. He would find stories that he thought I would be comfortable with and that I would like, and I would listen to them. And actually, it was refreshing that when I would let myself listen to the story and I could feel my body getting turned on, and I was like, okay, I am capable of being turned on. My body does respond. And that was a really hopeful step.
Yeah, I can see. That's great that you two were so open with each other and communicating enough that and helping each other out that way.
Yeah, and I mean, I really didn't want to do it, and I had to really go beyond my comfort level. I didn't, you know, to me, I just felt like I shouldn't need to have anything extra to be turned on, and a part of me felt like it was wrong, and that was one more way that I was defective because I shouldn't need that to get turned on. But as I would just go back and forth, I just finally was like, I just need to just do this. It's just worth the risk for the potential reward. Like, I need to push myself beyond my comfort level and just do it.
Yeah, that's brave. I mean, you pushed beyond the shame and the wiring that we have about
and just any
adequacy.
Other voices in my head from, you know, just church leaders or whatever, and just close everyone out and just be, this is what's happening in my life, and I have tried everything, and I need to try this too. And another thing that I kind of liked was there's a website called Marriage Heat, and I kind of like that too because it's just it's a website for Christian couples, married Christian couples, where they write their own sex stories to send to people to help other married couples. And so for me, I kind of like stuff that, you know, I like the erotic stories because it's fiction and just things that are just more morally comfortable for me when it's just kind of more within the bounds of things that I believe in anyway, like marriage and fiction.
So. Yeah, I've heard of that site, and that's been helpful for others. So I'm glad y'all found it. And yeah, speaking of you know, these particular stimuli, you know, where it's visual or auditory. Mm-hmm. There's something that one of our listeners brought up about porn and exploitation that. And I actually am glad that the conversation is going this way because, I mean, I will admit I was more of a black and white thinker earlier on in my career because I was, you know, I've seen how much damage talking about, pathologizing, you know, the sexuality to be like, okay, well, you know, ban porn. Porn is bad. So I thought, well, okay, you know, let's just take away the stigma. But at the same time, I mean, porn can be exploitative of women. So I like how you're talking about how you found something that was morally comfortable for you.
Yeah, for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've heard of feminist porn. It exists apparently, you know, or where they pay, you know, living wages and, you know, just that. Mm-hmm. I think you bring up a good point about how it's important to go about it in a way where you feel comfortable and don't feel morally, compromised by the material. And I know a lot of women, they feel and men too, male allies that are feminists that well, like, oh, this is just so objectifying, or I get that now. It's not so black and white, is it anymore?
Yeah, it's definitely not black and white. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just have to give props to Scott throughout this whole thing because he was so mature to be patient and supportive and constructive over the years. And also for him to be able to handle me needing a vibrator and erotica to help me get turned on. You know, some spouses might have felt really threatened by that and not wanted that. But for him, especially after so many years, he's just like, please, like if anything could turn you on, like I am okay with it. So, but I think that we all need to not be so threatened, you know, in our sexual relationships by dumb stuff like a vibrator or, you know, other stuff like that. So,
yeah, I definitely agree. And I've even talked to people who have progressed through, you know, initially feeling like a vibrator was cheating on their spouse in some way.
Right. Yeah.
To recognizing how it's just a tool and it's an important one. Yeah. And especially because in orgasmia is just so much more common than we think or that.
Yeah.
It can be like up to somewhere between 10% and 20%.
Right.
I mean, maybe have never even experienced an orgasm. So, and I am really impressed that you were able to point out what stage in the sexual response cycle, you know, you were having trouble with, and then targeting arousal. In this case, that was brilliant.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, you know, going back to when Scott divulged the porn and how that kind of actually expedited my trying to claim it for myself because I saw all of a sudden I saw that porn is a threat to my marriage and I no longer had the upper hand anymore that I had as a low drive sex partner. You know, I no longer felt like, okay, well, Scott needs me. I didn't feel that anymore. And I think that can really create a fight or flight response. And for me, it just created a fight response. Like I was just going to fight that much harder to make my sexual relationship better with Scott. And it also helped me just to not feel obligated anymore that the reason that I'm having sex is to keep him from sin and for regulating his sexuality. And so it could be about me and what I wanted.
Exactly. I love that. Tell me more about that, about how you reclaimed your sexuality for yourself and not, not dependent on Scott. I love that.
Well, I mean, you know, I've been reading all this stuff and everything forever, and I've been working on it for a long time, but it wasn't until it was the threat. It wasn't until I felt threatened that I felt the drive to push harder. Because I always thought those things. I always feel like, yes, of course women should have, you know, orgasms, and of course women this and that. But it wasn't until I had that where I was scared and didn't have the power that I was like, just wanted to reclaim it and reclaim it for myself. I mean, I don't know how to explain it more than that, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's great. And many women have described something similar. I wanted to ask you about, or follow up about another thing that you had said about the catalyzing event or the activating event was just Scott telling you about porn is that sometimes when I counsel couples or women about sexuality, some women feel guilt for you driving a man to porn, right?
Uh-huh.
That right. They're somehow responsible for right. his sexuality.
Right. Uh-huh.
Did you feel?
I didn't have that, you know. And as I've talked to other wives that are their husbands have a porn relationship, I've never had a lot of the typical responses that wives have, where And I can't even speak for them. I don't even know, because for me, I had none of those things. Like, Scott never made me feel bad about myself. He never made me feel like I wasn't good enough, or like my body wasn't good enough. He never took out anger on me. Like, it didn't affect our relationship in the way that I feel like it has affected some relationships. He just internalized everything and just hated himself and wanted to kill himself. So that's how it worked out in our marriage. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, and where he had a relationship with it for years before we got married, I just didn't take any ownership of that. I'm like, he had that baggage before we got married. It doesn't have anything to do with me. And that's honestly how I felt about it from the beginning. I didn't feel like, oh, I'm not good enough, and he's compensating because of this and that. And I'm like, no, he's been dealing with this for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe, oh, if I was better in the bedroom or whatever, I just didn't go there. I'm not going to claim that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I'm hearing you say that, and this is great, that as things started to unravel a bit in the relationship, that you know, you guys were forging new territory, you know, talking about his porn use, and then wanting to figure out, you know, how to reach orgasm, that it was for you. Mm-hmm. You know, you definitely seem to have been, you know, pretty courageously, you know, moving forward. Like, okay, you know, now's mm-hmm. the time. I'm gonna put in the emotional energy to discover what works for me. I love that.
Yeah. And so during that time, we set up an appointment with a PA that was recommended by Scott's therapist, who he was seeing because of his suicidality, because of porn. And we went in together, and I was there to get an overall physical, specifically because of my low sex drive and my anorgasmia. And he was there to get a prescription for Prozac because of his suicidality. So it's kind of a really crazy dynamic that we had going on at that time. But I was crying again because I was just so embarrassed about it. And you've heard me cry on here already. So I kind of cry with stuff that's personal to me. And I'm crying in front of this room of strangers again because this PA always liked to have lots of students with her. And so there's a group of people, and I'm like telling them about my struggles, and I'm asking her and saying, you know, I'm here to see if there's a physical component, you know. And that's the thing. It was that threat that drove me to be brave enough to ask a doctor again for help and to see if there's something physically wrong. And so I had a physical, and then they took my blood, and then a week later they called me back and they said the test results came back normal. And I was really kind of conflicted with that answer, because a part of me was disappointed and a part of me was relieved, because I just thought, you know, if I have a problem with my testosterone and I get a treatment and I still don't have an orgasm, I've failed again. And I'm defective that much more. And so it was a really mixed thing for me to realize that I was normal. But then a year later, I went back to get a regular checkup, and the PA asked me about, you know, my sex drive and stuff. And I told her that nothing had changed. And she said, well, let's go ahead and order another blood test. And so I was like, okay. So they did. And they called me back 3 days later and they said, your test results are normal. And I was like, okay. But then a week later, they called again and they said, actually, your testosterone is low. Can you come in for an appointment? And so I went in, and my testosterone is so low. It's barely on the charts. And so I asked the PA, I said, what was my testosterone last year? And she looked at her chart and she said, it was low last year. And I was so frustrated. I was like, I came in like a year ago crying because I can't have an orgasm, and I'm here to see if something is wrong with me physically, and they missed it. And I was just like, what the heck? Like, I mean, I'm glad that a year later we figured it out, but that was just really frustrating to me. It was validating, because I'm like, okay, there is something physically wrong with me that's consistent. My blood was bad last year too, and it's low this year.
They didn't catch it.
But I just couldn't believe that I'm in there specifically. I'm here getting a physical because my sex drive is low. And they missed that my testosterone was, like, barely on the charts. I'm like, what? Like, how does that happen? Anyway, that was frustrating.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe that they... Well, I mean, I can.
I know.
It's just,
and then I'm just like, oh, they're busy, and of course they missed it. But it's just like, this is, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a big deal to me. It's frustrating.
Because that's specifically why you went in.
Why I was there. Yeah. Ugh. Anyway, that wasn't so great. But so I started seeing her for the next several months. I would come in and I was trying different doses of testosterone and getting my blood drawn a lot. And I finally found a balance that really helped. And so between the help of erotica here and there and testosterone cream, it made leaps and bounds in the bedroom. And I have to say, I'm still not sure if I have orgasms, because what I read about an orgasm doesn't seem like that's what's happening to me. But stuff is happening, and things, my body is responding, and something is happening, and I call it an orgasm because I've never had anything else happen. So anyway, finally, after 10 long, very hard years of reading and just everything, I finally made some progress.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Wow.
It's been a long road.
And it is for many Mormon women. You're not alone. And, you know, since I'm specializing in women's mental health, like this topic, Mormon women's sexuality, is near and dear to my heart. And I am just floored by your bravery to come on here and be so open and share, in hopes that it can help someone else, that they're not alone, and that they're not crazy, or they're not, they're not defective. Oh yeah. Such.
Yeah. Not less than, you just feel less than, you just don't feel like a woman, know? And then what I found is that with that, I have such an easier time getting arousal quickly, and I don't even need anything. Like, I can just kiss Scott and feel arousal, and I just never had that. And he even got me to come to orgasm without a vibrator, which has been on his bucket list since our honeymoon, And so it's just been so amazing after all of this hard work, and we've just so happy about the progress that we've made.
Yeah, it sounds like you're definitely more in tune with your body at this point, with these sensations that you're able to be. Well, I mean,
And after you've felt it, it's easier to feel it again. That's the thing. It's like, if you've never felt arousal, you can't become aroused. You can be touched in any way whatsoever, and you're just not going to be aroused. Well, at least for me.
Yeah. I wasn't. Well, no, you're right. I mean, it's a process. You don't just go straight to orgasm. That's why I love doing sex therapy, because I feel like it's something that can really, just education helps so much. So from reading all that you did, you knew about the different stages in the sexual response cycle. So you knew it would be impossible to just go straight to orgasm without having the arousal and climax, and then
resolution. That's where I had to push myself, because in all the books, and especially They Were Not Ashamed, they'll just say the tips that they would give for arousal, and that any people would tell me, none of that worked for me, and so you just have to keep trying and keep fighting for it. And it's hard, though, because you kind of want to quit, because you feel it's exhausting to keep failing.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a negative cycle, right? Like you were saying earlier, that when it doesn't happen, then you feel more inadequate, and that all is never going to happen. And then that
you don't want to have sex. Like, who wants to have sex with that?
Yeah.
That baggage.
Nobody wants performance anxiety. It's not just in bed, but in church too. Sacrament meeting talks, performance anxiety is counterproductive. So, So you've come a long way, and you've taken, you know, the time and energy for yourself that so often we don't give ourselves because we're so focused on you know, pleasing our partner or just, you know, life happens, right? And mm-hmm. You know, sexuality would be just another thing to add onto the plate of mm-hmm. especially I've heard this from some clients, you know, that another thing to add to how I'm not measuring up,
right?
Yeah, I think the last thing we need.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say too that just like navigating the porn and the faith crises that we had, it just made us love each other so much more. Like instead of loving each other because we were both striving to meet the church's ideal conditions, when those kind of fell away, we had to decide if we could find reasons to love each other in spite of those conditions. And we just became more honest and vulnerable with each other. And it changed the way we hugged. It changed the way we kissed. We became more affectionate than we've ever been. And one of Scott's favorite changes is that we will send flirty texts back and forth, even if we're too tired at the end of the day to do anything about it later. But just having more of that, you know, just being more in love with each other, I guess. It's just been really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear it. Faith crises just in and of itself can be so tough on relationships.
Tough. Yeah.
Combine that feeling the pressure to perform in bed, and man, that's rough. So you tackled, it sounds like you tackled one at a time, or do you feel like it was you tackled them both, or what was that like for you?
They kind of just melted into each other. It's like the dealing with the porn kind of led to the faith crises, and so it's just been a pretty turbulent year and a half, 2 years. So they kind of were together, sort of. It started as one, and it is the other, mm-hmm. but very connected.
Yeah, because I've heard from others that emotions are so high as everything's starting to fall apart, right? That mm-hmm. that your world feels like it's just crashing down, and so
yeah,
it's intimacy is so important moving
yeah.
forward, and it's good practice for strengthening, you know, your sexual relationship, because yeah, you intimacy is an important skill that again, we're not really taught.
It's not easy, and it doesn't come naturally necessarily. You have to work for it.
Yeah.
And you have to stick up for yourself, both of you. You have to say, this is what I want, or this is what I need, and you have to try to help each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I really appreciate you coming back, Mitzi. I felt like, you know, after the first episode, like, oh, I wish I would have been able to talk to her more, and so I'm glad. I mean, is there anything that we left out? Anything that you want to say?
I'm at the end of my note.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Transitions. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a subscriber at mormontransitions.org. Music for this episode was provided by Iris Dement.
Some say they're going to a place called glory, and I ain't saying it ain't a fact. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. Well, I believe in love and to live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be.